welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik. Hope you're having a good week so far, despite Nice, despite Munich, and despite Normandy, and many, many more to come. I hope you take these opportunities to speak with your family, your friends, and help them to wake up and realize what is happening here and why it's happening, and explain to them that this is unfortunately only the beginning. Ask them if this is the kind of world that they want for their children. These horrors and attacks is something that we can use in a positive way to turn people towards a more sane and balanced view of the world that doesn't entail mass immigration and globalism. Don't miss our live DNC coverage from Tuesday to Thursday this week. We have several guests joining us as we check out some of the protests and comment on some of the DNC speeches. Tune in at redeyes.tv/live. Our guest today is Gilad Atzmon. He is an Israeli-born jazz musician and author that lives and works in England. He also writes on political matters, social issues, Jewish identity, and culture. Gilad is the author of The Wandering Who and From A to Zion, the definitive Israeli lexicon. Today we're going to speak about his take on the failed coup in Turkey, Brexit, the recent rise in terrorist attacks, Mammonism, and a whole lot more. We also have a video version available of this show, exclusive for members. So if you want to watch this show, go to redeyesmembers.com. Let's go over to Gilad. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you back again. So many things have been happening since we last spoke. We've had the coup in Turkey, number of terrorist actions. We've had Brexit. It's just a world of things that have been unfolding. But it's good to have you back here, Gilad. Always a pleasure having you here.
The same here. I always happy to talk to you, and I always learn a lot. So here I am, you know.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, thanks, Gilad. Let's just kind of talk a bit about the coup in Turkey first. You've written quite a bit on this on your website. I'd love to get your take on it. It seems like we more or less had a failed coup, or potentially a staged one by Erdogan himself. What's your analysis of the situation?
I don't think that this coup was staged, because knowing Turkey quite well, I'm visiting Turkey at least twice or three times a year, and I play music there, and I'm also giving talks, so I meet people of both poles of the political division, and I really mean it, which is an unusual situation. People, even within the regime in Turkey, don't trust each other, and it's not Gilad Atzmon saying it. You can see the scale of post-coup detention. A lot of people within the army, within the government, within the government offices, universities, and so on and so on. To stage a military operation, such a big military operation with F-16s in the air, with air-to-air missiles and tanks in the streets, with people whom you don't necessarily trust, is not a reasonable hypothesis. What I can say is that there were some serious rumor. This is how we looked at it a few days ago, or let's say Friday evening or Saturday, Sunday. Initially, the one thing that we knew was that there were a lot of rumors in Turkey that a purge was about to happen in August. And this is something that I heard from as early as 10 o'clock London time on that Friday. I mean, in the very early stages of the coup, where at the time Russia Today already decided that Erdogan is in Germany asking for asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And if you buy into that, it is more than likely there is a possibility that what we saw was a desperate attempt of a few generals and decision makers to to save themselves, to change the fate of Turkey and especially their own destiny and taking over the regime. However, I don't buy into that as well. What we understand now, and I think that this is the most reasonable way to look at it, and it is the most interesting, is that, as we know, in June, Erdogan issued an apology to Putin for shooting down two Sukhoi 24 jets
right.
last year. This telephone call, which was obviously premeditated, you know, it's like, it's not you don't call another president. There were a kind of negotiation before it, led to a clear attempt to reinstate the amicable relationship between Turkey and Russia.
Right.
The meaning of it was, and by the way, Benjamin Netanyahu was also part of that kind of a new peace initiative. It became very clear that some people who are deeply involved in the region changed their minds about the Syrian conflict. It is not a secret that Turkey was at the forefront of the NATO neocon Israeli intervention project.
Mm-hmm.
It was a launching pod for all those air raids from southern Turkey, and it is very clear that the Turks, or at least the leadership, realized that unless they change direction dramatically, Turkey is about to become the new Syria.
Right.
The borders in the region cannot be protected. Also, Turkey is a Muslim state, and it would become subject to this kind of radicalization with the amount of refugees that are flooding in. This only increases the danger, and so on and so on. Basically, Turkey was on a path of recovering its very good relationship with Russia. And some generals who were trained by NATO and some pilots who were trained in the United States saw that such a maneuver would affect the Turkey that they like to see. Now, I know that in Turkey, everyone tends to, within the government, tends to accuse Gulen, and this is that cleric who lives in Pennsylvania. And this may be possible. I obviously don't know the details, but we have to remember that Turkey, there are some other very strong political elements, like the Kemalites, the people who see themselves of the carriers of Ataturk, the pseudo-European Western Turkey. And many of them are in the army and in high positions. And I tend to believe that what we saw in Turkey was actually primarily a Kemalite, which is pro-Western, pro-NATO, attempt. It is very possible that Gulen was involved with it. What is most amazing about it is the way I saw it, and I was following all news channels on that Friday. It wasn't clear where Erdogan was in the early hours. When I spoke with my friends who are connected with the party, they were actually very desperate. He said they some one of them said he shouldn't have left Istanbul. In fact, he wasn't in Istanbul to start with. What we know now is actually he left Marmaris and he tried to land in Istanbul,
right.
Knowing that there are hostile F-16 in the air, and we even know that one of them locked his radar on the private jet where Erdogan was flying. But what is amazing is that, and you know, I'm not very original here, is that the president has managed to turn things around with a Facebook call, calling his people on on an iPhone or whatever gadget it was. And the most shocking thing is that the people went to the streets and defeated a military force. Now, I was quite shocked by it, but it's quite easy to explain. The most noticeable thing about Turkey, I think, is the fact that it's extremely nationalist place, and unlike Arabic society, Arab nationalism, where you see the pictures of the leader of on every building, like Hafez al-Assad in Syria, in or Nasser in Egypt, and so on and so on. In the case of Turkey, what we saw in the streets was where it was these huge flags. People went to the street with the flags, and they basically bare-handed they defeated those military faction. Now, one of the reasons is that the foot soldiers in the street. And this is something that I knew already Friday evening. They didn't realize, I'm not talking about the elite units that participated in some kind of, the attempt to assassinate Erdogan in his hotel. The soldiers who captured the bridges and so on and so on were basically foot soldiers. They were convinced, as I understand it now, as I understood it already then, on the night, they were sure that they were participating in a military drill. They didn't realize, they couldn't understand the full picture. Some of them, like in Taksim, when they understood the full picture, they gave up, because they are the Turkish people. There is no real difference between them and the Turks in the street. The other way around to look at it is that the Turkish themselves are, every Turkish man is going to the army. There is compulsory duty there. For them, soldiers with machine guns or tanks or even pilots are people like themselves, so they don't see them as an occupation force. It's not like the same situation as the Palestinian facing an Israeli soldier, and this is why they were not afraid to march towards them. And by the way, in some places we know that quite a few Turks died on civilians, died on these incidents. What was shocking for me, and I should mention it, and there was a huge debate on the topic on my Facebook, I was shocked to find out that some of my followers and the people who visit my writing regularly were totally, 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 totally anti, anti-Turkish. They saw the those civilians who stood up for the government. By the way, together with even the opposition party, all of them were against the coup. Those friends of mine, apparently they are not friends of mine anymore. They saw them as a bunch of Islamists, thugs. They called them Islamofascists and barbarians. What was shocking for me was to find out that they actually adopted the neoconservative, which is basically a Jewish school of thought. These are people who actually, all of them are a big supporter of Assad and the Syrian people. Mm-hmm. When it came to the Turks, they attributed all the entire, neocon terminology that refers to Muslim terrorists. And it was quite embarrassing because in their worldview, and they are very slow, they are not the most advanced intellectually, in their worldview, Erdogan is an anti Assad operator. Therefore, the people who came to help him were basically Islamist, ISIS, and so on and so on. Now, the picture is completely the other way around.
So there's no support of Turkey in with ISIS and these kinds of things. We've had some reports coming out on this, right? There's been some footage at the border.
let me just finish.
Sure,
because
sure.
What is so amazing about it is that the true story is the other way around. The coup happened because Erdogan actually made the U-turn on Syria. Because Erdogan, just 2 weeks, just 3 days actually before the coup, on Wednesday, exactly 2 days before the coup, it was revealed that Turkey is looking forward to reinstate its relationship with Syria. What actually happened, that it was a pro-NATO coup, and the people whom some of my followers call Islamists actually fought against the interest of the Islamists. Because the interest of the Islamists, what I don't like to use the word Islamists, what they call the Islamists,
mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Right.
I can explain why if you want, but there is no such a thing as Islamists. It's a Jewish invention. What they called Islamists or jihadists or all those kind of, how they kind of, terrorist-like terminology, they wanted to sustain NATO intervention. This is the old deal. So I think that we are very lucky to see such a huge geopolitical transition. You know, this is something that you read about in history. There is a war and suddenly people change sides. You know, we now read about World War One, and we realize that Jewish intelligentsia was very pro-war, the German Jews, and at a certain stage in the war, they changed signs, and we have Balfour Declaration, blah, blah, blah. This is amazing. It took us 50, 60 years to understand it, to start to write about it, and look at us now. It is happening in front of us, and we understand it within 2-3 days.
Right.
It's amazing.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty complex situation because we've had some footage coming out from the borders of Turkey. You know, Turkey, as you say, they have problems with Syria. We have the issue of Kurdistan, all these kinds of issues.
Sure.
And we know that the European Union and NATO have been very adamant about trying to get, you know, Turkey involved to be a pawn of them of sorts, right? So,
yeah.
You know, you people would see that an action like this would, an attempt to topple Erdogan might have been an attempt to try to move things in a better direction, but what you're saying is not so.
Better direction for NATO, and Erdogan understood it. Now, you have to remember another thing that is completely unrelated, but it is related now when we know how the events unfolded. 2-3 weeks ago, we had the Brexit poll in Britain.
Right.
For the Brits, Turkey was at the center of the discussion. So in spite of European promising the EU promising the Turkey that it will be integrated into the EU in the near future, and there is a big deal now with refugees, here in Britain, the the Leave campaign said we don't want anything to do with Turkey.
Of course.
And Cameron, who was the chief Remainer campaigner, being the prime minister, he came with strange promises that it will never happen, or it will won't happen in the near future, or in the next decade, and so on and so on. Now, look at that, on this development, from a Turkish perspective. Turkish people, they are there on the border, they are taking all those refugees, they are fighting this dirty war for NATO, for Britain, that started this entire mess in the region with this idiotic Tony Blair, who followed the orders from the Jewish lobby in Israel. And they get nothing in return, and they are constantly being humiliated. You know, the English people have to decide whether Muslim Turkish can join the EU because they are Muslims and we don't want them in. And this is exactly the kind of climate, political climate, that led all those Turkish to come to the street. They said, we want to live in this country that was shaped or reshaped by the AK party, by Erdogan, that brought us economic prosperity. We have to remember, this is actually crucial, and actually you will find it very interesting, I think. You know, we talk about the Bolsheviks and their impact on the Russian people, and we know very well, we are entitled to talk about it now, that Bolshevism was primarily a Jewish movement.
Right.
What the Yuri Slezkin comes with a very interesting point. He says that in the beginning, and I think that maybe I mentioned it once on your program, kind of a deja vu, but it's a crucial point now when we deal with Turkey. Yuri Slezkin says, in the beginning of the 20th century, East European Jews are divided into three groups. One really wants to be Russians, to integrate into the Russian society, but the Russians don't let them integrate because the Slavophilic, the Russian elite, is at large, very racist and very anti-Jewish. What do? They reinvent themselves and they become Zionists. They move to Palestine, and in Palestine they pretend to be Russian. This is how I grew up. Part of half of my family is kind of, it could be seen as this as a kind of offshoot of that intellectual or ideological setting. I grew up kind of in a socialist, Russian wannabe. I can play and sing every Russian song probably in Russian without being able to speak Russian.
Mm-hmm.
The second group really wanted to integrate into Russia, to become Russians, to assimilate. They couldn't for the same reason. They invented Bolshevism and they made the Russians into Jews. This is the Bolshevism.
Right.
This is very crucial, and we'll get back to it in a second. And, you know, the attempt to Judify the Russian lasts for quite long, let's say from 1917 to the 1990s. The third group didn't want to be Russians, didn't want to assimilate with the Russians, they wanted to be Jews. And according to Yuri Slezkin, they moved to America because America is the real promised land.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Now, interestingly enough, we speak about the second group. They made the Russians into Jews by means of Bolshevism. Zionism repeated pretty much the same tactics. It made the Jews into something that they weren't. They say, we don't like the Jews being non-productive, being involved with the trading only, stock exchange, banking, and so on and so on. We want the Jew to become a decent human being, and they invented Zionism. They decided to do it through homecoming on the expense of the Palestinian people. Interestingly enough, exactly the same thing happened in Turkey in the same years. The end of First World War, we see this revolution led by Ataturk, who, by the way, according to more than a few historians, Israelis and Turks, was himself a Jew.
Right.
It was okay. a Jew, offshoot of the Sabtai Ben Tzvi, who was kind of the last failed Messiah, and it's a very interesting, people can read it. People say that both Ataturk and the young Turks, who are the people that basically committed the massacre of the Armenians,
yeah,
were at large kind of a Jewish sect. It's a very interesting story. I don't like to talk about history. People can check it and make up their minds, check all the sources. What they did to the Turks was very similar to the project that was imposed on the Jews by Zionists and the project that was imposed on the Russians by the Bolsheviks. They told them, we want to be different people. They took the language, they took the calligraphy, the Arab writing, and made it into a Western alphabetic system. Which means that Turks in 1922 couldn't even read the letters that their father sent to them from Gallipoli. Yeah,
right.
It created a complete, it was an attempt to alienate the Turk from their heritage, from their culture, from their upbringing. And here we see, Turkish society living through this Ataturk, and everybody is sure that they really want to be Europeans. And by the way, many of them do want to be Europeans and see themselves as European. And by the way, they celebrate their European culture quite freely. I cannot say totally freely because this would be a lie. And I saw it myself that there are some issues. And then pretty much out of the blue, 60, 70 years later, we see that in spite of all this suppressive political method, Islam came back, Erdogan became the prime minister, his popularity is huge. It's not something that we even recognize in the West, that scale of popularity.
Right.
If Obama tells you to go to the street calling you from an iPhone, would you do it? Would people do it for Merkel?
Probably
would,
not.
Would people do it for Theresa May or for Cameron?
Right.
They would do it for Putin, I think. And they would do it for Ahmadinejad. Some leaders as this unique capacity to embody what the people see as their natural, authentic will. This is not very surprising. Some people think that they have this tendency, and they don't have it at all. You know, one of the most tragic cases here in Britain is the case of Corbyn.
Right. Yes.
You know, if you would talk to me about Corbyn a year ago, I'll tell you, man, I'm over the moon. You know, this man, you know, was all his life. He knows exactly what is going on. After, you know, it was, I don't know, 50 years he was in this parliament, in this idiotic house. He should know what Jewish power. And then once, and his popularity within the party was huge. A lot of young members joined in, and he won quite easily on the first one against like 6 or 7 candidates. And then a week later, I noticed that the first thing that he did was to go to try to talk to the Jewish lobby. To appease them.
Right, yeah.
And I realized that the guy is probably a very good guy, but, you know, intellectually, extremely lame, extremely, quite miserable, kind of a wimp, you know. So I don't think that the young people would go to
the streets for Corbyn.
To the streets for him. By the way, I may be wrong, because if there is something that his support is based on those young people, but it's definitely not a popular movement. He communicates with these kind of relatively well-educated young people who like to see themselves as leftist potential Guardian readers. Unfortunately for them, they won't be Guardian in 2-3 years. But this is another problem. But anyway, it's very clear that he is not Putin. There is something about this nationalism that comes together with a general sense of justice, whether it is true or not, it's a big question. You know, some people insist both in Russia and in Turkey that the regime is corrupted and so on and so on and so on. You know, we know about Russian oligarchs, and there are some stories about the Erdogan families. You know, I don't want to go into it. But even when these stories come along, they are not perceived by the people as genuine criticism, but as an attempt to smear their beloved leaders. It's as if somebody is talking about your son or daughter you just don't want to hear. You know, I know, forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is indeed fascinating. Now, we go back to talk about Brexit. Something very similar happened here in Britain. Just three, four weeks ago. Again, it's the exact same story of oppression. For many years, we couldn't talk about immigration. We couldn't talk about foreign labor. We couldn't talk about ethnicity. We couldn't talk about race. All that time, this country was flooded by immigrants. I am myself an immigrant, and I came within this wave of immigration that was imposed on this country.
Which, as you know, Blair, exactly. He opened the gates.
Exactly.
Yeah, we know the story. Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm not at all an anti-immigrant, but I think that, anti-immigration. I'm very happy that I was accepted here, and I have a great career here, and I'm very happy about it. But what was shocking is that it's not that people and natural tendency to think in a racial or ethnic terms or in terms of belonging disappeared, it was just oppressed. Once we had the Brexit, that turned into an opportunity to celebrate belonging, we found out that if you move, it looks as if it was 50-50, 52-48, but if you take out London, right, and you take out Scotland,
mm-hmm,
and you take out Northern Ireland, and these are basically different countries, yeah, you realize that once you leave London, M25, our kind of, peripheric motorway, once you leave London, you are in a land with 80, 85, 90% people support the Leave,
yep,
campaign.
That's right.
All right? This is England. This is real England. And why? Because those ideas, sense of belonging, is the strongest feature in the sense of being. It's what you are. It's loving the soil, loving the sky, the fish, the language, the women who are your women and speak your language, your unique poetry, your unique humor. And this is something that was taken from the Western subject. And this is the most interesting topic that we should talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see, just a reflection of that, but did you happen to see any of the riots from Hyde Park, Black Lives Matter in London?
No, because I was touring and all my stuff is up through reading. No, tell me about it.
So there was a Black Lives Matter that has actually picked up in London as well, and there was a huge demonstration in Hyde Park, or demonstration.
Yeah.
It basically turned into a nightmare for the cops, you know?
No, this is very, it's slightly pathetic of me, but I missed it. When did it happen?
This is just a few days ago.
Yeah, I was in Czech Republic, and then I toured the year with the blockade, and I missed. But this is quite amazing, because one of the most incredible thing about Britain, our cops are really, really, really nice.
Yeah, they're too nice. One officer was stabbed during this, by the way, too, but they had to flee the scene basically because it was such a riot, you know.
Yeah, but this is a huge issue. Maybe they are not as nice when they are faced with people with dark skin. Maybe then their attitude is different. I have to look at it, but it's definitely very different from the United States. When you are approached by a cop in the United States for a minor traffic offense, you always find yourself intimidated, and this is something that is very foreign to my experience in Britain. I remember like 2-3 years ago, I was on the way to a concert in New York, and a friend the friend that brought me over made a mistake, and I was a bit late, and we were stopped by a cop, and I told him, listen, I think that I'm late, can I come out of the car? And he said, you better not do it, you know. And I said, but can I come, and I have to take my saxophone and go to the gig. He said, if you open the trunk, you are real, you are in real trouble. And if you were black, they will shoot you. Now, this kind of attitude or this kind of fear is not something that I've ever experienced in Britain. That's the way it is, you know.
They don't have as many cops getting shot there either. I mean, look at the attacks on police officers.
Our cops don't go with guns.
Right.
Only very few of them.
Yeah.
To start with. you know, you give guns to cops, you have a problem. You have a problem, and they shoot, you know, apparently they shoot, as many white as black. They just,
more whites, actually. More whites are shot.
More white. I know, yeah. I know the statistics.
Yeah.
Now, I try to be polite.
You have to be polite here.
Correct,
yeah, you know? Exactly.
but the thing is, the most important issue about Brexit is that, as I see it, it is a huge, huge, huge diversion. And by the way, I believe that Trump and Sanders are a similar kind of diversion. What do I mean by that? The problem that we have in Britain, or the problem that the vast majority of Brits encounter, is the fact that they don't have a prospect of a future. There is no work. Work is basically nostalgia here. You can probably become an estate agent you walk in a corner shop, but there are no work labor providers. There are no factories. There are no mines. And this is very different from the society I grew up and most Brits in my age were raised in. People in my age knew that if you are clever, you go to university, but if it doesn't work out, you go back and you go to work in a factory.
Right. You can always get a job.
You make more tortinas.
Yeah.
Or Ford Escort. Or Land Rover. Or go to work in Rolls Royce and make engines for airplanes. Or Boeing. Or go to work in Sheffield Steel. Our economy became service economy. England is a place that produces very little, maybe nothing, really. No, I shouldn't say nothing, but very little. And yet we are the fifth, now sixth, greatest economy. How come? 75% of our economy is service economy, which means that a fraction of 1% is making all that capital. I started to look into it and to try to define it categorically, and I realized that what we are dealing with is a capitalism that is driven by trade. I called it mammonism, from the biblical word mammon, wealth.
Right.
We are dealing with mammonism. Mammonism is capitalism that is driven by trade, by banking, by commodities, by stock exchange,
yeah. gambling
as to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And it's good that you mentioned gambling. We'll get to it in a second. And as opposed to capitalism that is driven by manufacturing, by production, the difference between capitalism that is driven by manufacturing is that it provides a prospect of a future for the entire society. So if you are entrepreneurial, you will probably end up in the leading, if you are entrepreneurial and very gifted at it, rather than just thinking that you are an entrepreneurial, you will end up within the elite. If you are very clever, you would be involved in engineering. And if you are not very gifted intellectually, you would find your place in the production line, but yet if you are very gifted musically, you will play in a band in the night. And this is exactly what Britain was in the 60s, and even in the 70s, you know, and obviously before. When I was starting to write about it, I realized that I wasn't original at all. I realized that I kind of recycle ideas that I'm slightly familiar with, and it took me a few minutes before I realized that I actually went back to Henry Ford.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Henry Ford was a very controversial being, wrote a book in 1920s, and some people say that even himself said at a certain stage that he didn't write it. I don't know. When you buy the book, it comes under his name, so I assume that he wrote it. He wrote a book called The International Jew. And I realized that what I define as Mammonism is exactly what Henry Ford defined as the International Jew, which is very, very, which is very, very interesting, because Henry Ford don't argue that every Jew is an international Jew. He argues that the international Jew is a Jew who deal with capital for the sake of capital. And Henry Ford himself was the complete opposite. Henry Ford had a vision of society. We can like this vision or not. He had a vision of a society where people are extremely productive. Shockingly enough, Henry Ford and his book, The International Jew, that are regarded as the most anti-Semitic text, and Henry Ford himself as the icon of anti-Semitism. Both the book and the ideas of Henry Ford in general are identical with early Zionism. What he says about the international Jew is identical with what Borokhov, Ade Gordon, Berl Katzenelson, these are early Zionists, saying about the diaspora Jews. This is why they decided to take the Jews to Zion, i.e. Palestine, and to tell them, you are going to walk in the fields. And by the way, they walked in the fields for 2 weeks, and then they found that the Palestinians were cheaper. And when the Palestinians couldn't walk anymore, because the oppression was, you know, there was a war, so they brought Thais and other workers from the Philippines. All right? So when it comes to Henry Ford, I realized that he actually identified a very dangerous pattern in American society back in 1920s. Now, let's assume that he wrote the book. I don't want to get now into conspiracies, and I don't care if he wrote it or not. Whoever wrote it was extremely observant and managed to see back in 1920s that American society is on the dangerous path. Now, assuming that it was Henry Ford who wrote it, it is very easy to understand why he noticed it. He was a genius manufacturer. He saw a complete bond between, or even continuum between himself and his workers. As we know, Henry Ford was the one who established the minimal wages.
Right.
I think in 1907, somebody should check it out. Don't trust me on that. But the story is true. He realized that he made a huge profit, annual profit, and the money that went to his workers, there were tens of thousands of them at the time after he started with the T model, the profit, only a fraction of the profit went to the workers. He went to the workers and told them, from tomorrow morning, you are going to make $5 a day instead of two. I can tell you that it never happened to me in my life that someone came to me and told me from tomorrow morning, we pay you two times and a half more publishing. Or right. For your concert or for your services.
Yeah.
All right? So he saw a continuum, he saw a commitment between himself and the workers. But then he was standing there. He was all the time under the constant pressure from the money people, the Wall Street. And he could identify them because when he looked at them, he saw that many of them were actually Jews of a certain kind. He didn't speak about the Jews. He spoke about the international Jews, most of the text. And then at a certain stage, he started to feel some pressure from below. And these were the unions. And once again, he looked at them, and he saw the Bolshevik Jewish interest, the Jewish socialist. He was actually subject to a kosher, lethal sandwich.
Right.
All right?
Right.
This is the Jewish sandwich that managed, let me speak Yiddish, you probably won't understand me, to kvetch. You know what is to kvetch? To smash.
No.
To smash. Right. To smash. To smash the Western society. On the one end, we have those, you mentioned gambling. So we have Edelson.
Right.
It smells that Trump may become the president immediately. He said, I'm the Jew for Trump. We have that. Yeah.
From the top. Yeah. Yeah.
From the top.
Bankers,
from the top.
Elites, yeah.
Know? And then we have all the other people who, for instance, operating. I'm not a Trump supporter, but it's just to show how this model works. All those black matters and blah 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 things that are very important, or you know, but
the progress of the media, basically, right? Those who have been programmed,
the progressive media, and so on,
yeah.
is working against Trump, for instance. And, you know, when you look at the funding, you realize that it is Soros behind it. This is a kosher sandwich. This is a kosher sandwich, and this is a disaster, because look where America is now. You know, you have to choose between Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Well, the choice is easy for me, I gotta say. I mean, Hillary is like, oh, she's one of the most corrupt that ever existed. I don't know that much about Trump, but obviously, we could talk more about this in the second hour, Gilad. We're going to take a break here in just a couple of minutes. But obviously, okay. He has managed to attract the middle class. Again, whether he's genuine or not, he's obviously channeling a true consent, a discontent.
We can definitely talk about it. I didn't try to enter the debate whether Trump is good or bad, or is the favorite candidate. I just wanted to show how, without us noticing, the same people squash you from above and from below.
Of course.
And it gives me the feeling, and you know, I can show you exactly the same thing with Cameron, with Theresa May, that 2 months before she was appointed to be our prime minister. She was in a Jewish gathering with this placard, "Je suis juif," and she did it for a reason, because she knew that she was probably aware of her ambitions. And you can talk about Hollande, we can talk about any world leader of any significance, and I'll show you how this is working. You know, in Hillary, you don't even need me. Yeah, here it is.
Showing the footage here for people.
Yeah, showing the footage, yeah, when she's talking. And by the way, if you, obviously, most of your followers, except the Antifa, don't speak Hebrew, but to listen to her, she makes so many mistakes, and she knows that she makes mistakes. It's quite hilarious to watch. Maybe we should show it to your, you know, she gets all the words wrong, you know. She obviously, she wasn't subject to a proper circumcision, and this is why she can get, you know.
Right, right.
By the way, if you roll it back, I don't know about the politics. She has beautiful legs.
All right. Well, Gilad, tell us a bit about your website here. I want you to plug the site a bit here and tell us kind of what you have available for people before we take a short break and then continue talking about all this in the second.
So my website is gilad.co.uk, gilad.co.uk, and I have a few books around. The Wondering Who is probably my best-selling non-fiction, and you can either buy that or find it somewhere on the net. And if you want to save the time and read it in kind of 5 minutes, you have to go for the A to Zion, which is basically the Wandering Who in the toilet version, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. All right. Excellent. Gila.co.uk, folks, is the website. Yeah, it's interesting. We'll try to get a little bit closer to Gilad's thoughts about all the current events that's been going on, from Brexit to Turkey to the situation here with the pressure from above and pressure from below that he's just kind of really getting into here. So, yeah, we'll take a short break. We'll continue in the second hour. Stay with us, Gilad. We'll be right back with more. in the members hour, we focus on Brexit and the newly appointed PM Theresa May and her clampdown on free speech in Britain. We're also going to discuss Trump and the comparison people make to Hitler and analyze if there is actually some truth to it or not. Gilad gives his take on the rise of nationalism in Europe and indications that we are living in a post-political era as reflected in the miserable failures of NATO and the disastrous multicultural experiment. It's a good second hour, so definitely don't miss it. Go to redeyesmembers.com and get yourself a membership if you haven't already. And there you can also watch the video version of this show. We have tons of other radio programs, interviews, and videos for you on our members' website as well. We have upcoming on the program Guillermo Rudolph, Colin Flaherty, and many more. So we'll take a short break right here. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back after this.